Welcome to Twig 258. We've got a full cast today. We've got Philip Black, game economist at Game Economist Consulting.
Hey, hey.
We've got Eric Kress, principal at Gossamer Consulting Group.
Yep.
Jen Donahoe, marketing executive at Jade Inferno Consulting.
Howdy, everyone.
Mishka's back. We've got Mishka Katkoff, founder of Deconstructor of Fun.
Hey, son.
And you've got me, Laura Taranto, head of new games at Big Fish. Eric, how are you this morning?
I'm grouchy. Evidently, according to Mr. Brett Novak, we're both grouchy a little bit. So Brett put out a post on LinkedIn basically suggesting that, you know, we're too grouchy maybe and that we should change our ways. And it got me thinking, am I too grouchy? Am I too outraged on a constant basis? Is my age catching up to me? So bear with me for a quick story. I just want to know, the goal of the story is fundamentally, am I a Karen Kyle or was I outraged for good reason? That's what I really want to know from you guys and from anybody out there that's willing to comment. All right, quickly. I was with my son out to dinner at Chipotle, which is a Mexican chain for all those of you in Europe. And it was like 8 p.m. The store was fucking empty with a few folks eating and one person in the line, right, who was actually chatting with a friend of hers. So she wasn't even ordering, right? We asked for a quesadilla. The woman behind the counter said, the only way that we can get a quesadilla is if we order online ahead of time. And I looked at her with obvious confusion and slight outrage. And I said, you mean if I order online now, you can make it, but if I order it here, you won't make it. And she said, yes. And I'm like, let me talk to your manager immediately. The young manager comes out and he says, this is a new policy because making quesadillas disrupts the flow of food prep. Quesadillas have to be made in the back, so which takes workers from the front to the back, which messes up their flow, I suppose. And I say in absolute full outrage, like a Kyle, that there is no one here and no flow to disrupt. And I said, just go back there and make the goddamn quesadilla, right? And he says, no, you have to order it online. The woman chatting with her friend was absolutely disgusted. My son was probably a little bit embarrassed, but I just walked away in a huff. All right. So do I have the right to be outraged or do I need to check myself?
I checked Chipotle stock. It's up 41%. They are right. You're wrong.
The almighty dollar is working against me?
Yes, yes. You're clearly disrupting a process that is going very well. You can compare their stock to McDonald's, whoever owns Burger King and others, Yum Foods or whatever it is. Chipotle is doing really well on the market. So I'm a...
Are you saying this because quesadillas are a huge percentage of the stock?
No,
price?
Because they clearly have the process and Chris comes in and wants a customized process and they have a process that is working. They're profitable. The
no,
stock
but this
is up
is a
42%.
New process that just started. For the record, I went to another Chipotle like a few blocks away and the guy was like, I asked him, I said, is this the policy? He's like, yes, this is the policy. We do not make quesadillas unless you order online. But he basically said, we do not follow this policy. You can order the quesadilla at the register because it doesn't make a lot of sense from our perspective that to have quesadillas made in the back. So I felt redeemed at that moment, but I still felt like I went over the top in terms of outrage. And my biggest fundamental problem in my life is that I can never hide how I'm thinking. I can't lie, right? Because I'm always rolling eyes. Body language is all over the place. I mean, it was absolutely clear that I wanted to go across that goddamn counter and strangle this but I didn't. I just want to know, do I have the right to be outraged at these type of things, or am I just getting old and crotchety, and Brett and I have no hope whatsoever of pulling out of this grouchiness?
Well, the answer is yes to all of that. In my perspective, you had a right to be outraged. It doesn't make any sense as a consumer, especially if it was on the menu and you can see it. I would like that. And they're like, no. And that is a very bad customer experience. In games, we would never do something like that. Dear player, you can purchase this way, but or you have to go to the web store to get it. Like, we wouldn't do that to people. But number two is I'm similar. I'm shaking my stick as well as an old person. Get off my lawn. These days, I don't put up with shit. You and I should not play poker. Is the gist of the story.
No, I'm total mush in poker, 100%. Like everyone, I just get destroyed. All right, let's move on. This is not all that interesting. Brett got me going a little bit.
Shout out to Chipotle. I missed that. That was my favorite chain. I would eat there like three times a week at least. Anyway, quick chill before I get crucified. I feel like when Grouchy Cress is on the podcast and I have missed the last episode, that's usually a good combo to be a torn a new one. But I'm going to just show an event happening this month at Slush. It's called Mad Mixer. So Makers Fund, Areem, and Deconstructor Fund are throwing a mixer on 30th of November, starting at 7 p.m. There's going to be minimum 100 founders, executives, and investors. There's no sign-up link because it's an invite only. And if you want to be invited, many people have reached out, where is the link? There's no link. If you want to be invited, you're not on the list, you haven't received it, you can connect with me and I can get you on the waiting list. We're going to pack the house. I'm going to go and see the event space early next week, but it's going to be a lot of fun. Philip Black from Game Economist Consulting is going to be there, clean shaven and all beautiful from Stockholm. So come to see us and come hang out. It's going to be rowdy.
Speaking of which, dude, the beard ain't working there, Mishka. You got to shave that shit off, dude.
I'm trying.
Or just have to, you got to fill it in. That's what girls do with their eyebrows sometimes. You just fill it in. You get like a little pen. Boop.
I'll be watching Beckham document and he has like this beard thing going and I'm like, damn it, I'll try. I keep trying.
You can do whatever you want if you're the world's most famous footballer.
I understand
and
that.
And the handsomest guy on the planet.
We can try. We can learn. We can take cues. No. But anyway, I want to do a little correction before we move on. I want to say question about Supercell. So there was a question a couple weeks ago that I asked just impromptu during the podcast is, will Supercell be bought for the third time? And if they will, who will buy them? And just to be clear, I love Supercell. I think it's a fantastic company. There was no disrespect there. On the contrary, I think it's such a great company, such a great asset that a lot of companies would be interested in acquiring them. And if we do a quick SWOT analysis of Supercell, the strength is that they're very profitable. They have a fantastic deal flow for the investment team. The weaknesses are, of course, the declining portfolio and that they haven't been able to ship new games since 2018. They got a lot of opportunities that they're seizing by building bigger live ops teams and the Supercell store as well as Supercell ID. So you've seen a lot of advertising for Supercell X, not to be confused with Twitter. And that whole platform that they're building is clearly done to own their players, player data, as well as to pay less to the platform holders. Now, but the threat is pretty big one, and that's why I was asking this question. And I think the threat is one word, and that is China. With the geopolitical crisis, with the new president that might be coming back, looking at the poll, very likely is coming back. What is happening is a lot of sanctions. And if something happens, and if China is getting hit with sanctions, that would immediately be cascaded or influenced on the companies that are especially holding data. And one of those companies is, of course, Tencent. And that would possibly lead for the need to divest. There's a lot of speculation, but the world is crazy right now. And there has been a lot of crazy stuff happening. I'm just saying this could happen. So that could be one of the elements. Or the other one is just Tencent wants to bolster their other portfolio. They don't want to be so invested into mobile. They want to move somewhere else. And they're moving some pieces. Yeah, this is just Mishka, speculation.
Stop talking.
Yeah,
just stop talking.
All right.
What you're saying makes any sense.
We'll
I don't know who is whispering in your ear. The fact of the matter is that Tencent was early and active in acquiring assets outside of China as a strategic reason, of which NetEase and others are doing the exact same thing. And there's no way they would divest their crown jewels in the U.S. because that protects them from the crazy things that are going on in China. And furthermore, if it got to a point in which the U.S. government was coming after Supercell and shutting them down or legislating against them, dude, it'd be World War III. There's just no way that geopolitically, and I'm no expert, that can happen without like serious issues in the world governments, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, if they go after TikTok, yeah, sure. Got it. Yes, that could happen. I actually can see that happen. But when they start going after game companies that are targeting primarily adults, I don't think that is likely going to happen. And they don't want to give up those assets that gives them leverage outside of China.
You're most likely right. So hypothetical question. Anyway, what do you think about my behavioral economics conversations with Chris Hewish?
I have no opinion, but you know who might have opinion is the economist on the podcast.
I'm so sorry to Chris and I'm so sorry to you, Mishka, although a little bit less. I can't do the behavioral economics bullshit anymore. And it wasn't just that podcast. It's been a series of interactions, and it's always from product people. Because if you look at any product manager's bookshelf, they always have Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow somewhere on there, and then some sort of like bullshit Dan Ariely book.
I have all of them.
Laura is just nodding like, yes.
It's part of the course. So it's a rotten at its core, right? Behavioral economics, as opposed to what? The unbehavioral economics? All economics is behavioral. Of course, we're trying to explain and understand human behavior. So there's no such dichotomy. What you really mean to say is when psychologists try to do economics. And so let's look at the track record of psychologists trying to do economics, which is what people commonly look to when they talk about behavioral economics. Let's look at Dan Ariely, who is under investigation for academic fraud on a paper about truth. He is the person who wrote Predictably Irrational, which every PM seems to have read. Let's talk about Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. A lot of that research has not replicated in the time since that book has been published, and no one wants to talk about it. What they do love to talk about when it comes to psychology is all these edge cases of human behavior, because it makes them feel smart, right? And the number one thing they go after, they love this punching bag, the psychologists who can't seem to replicate out of a box. People are not rational. And it's because they always use a straw man definition of rationality rather than the one economists have been proposing since the 1960s. They just completely ignore that definition. All economists mean by rationality is that people have preferences. Preferences are ranked, and people try to choose the highest ranked preference after accounting for budget constraints. It is a testable hypothesis. It has been replicated and validated over and over and over and over again. We see this every single day in our human lives. Demand curves do slope downward. Supply curves, by the way, they don't always slope upward. There's backbending supply curves. There's some weird stuff that goes on there. But yes, people tend to behave in a way that is considered rational. Now, are there fringes of human behavior where we might need more fringe psychological explanations to help understand what's going on? Absolutely. And when we get to that place, what we should rely on is economists trying to explain the behavior, because they have a far better track record of using empirical evidence and proposing falsifiable theories. So dump Dan Ariely, dump Francesca Gina, who's also under academic fraud, by the way, and pick up Thaler. If you want to understand behavioral economics, read Richard Thaler, who won a Nobel Prize on this. Read his 1990s anomalies paper. That is the great place to start here. There's just so much bullshit that I see. Like, you go to a grocery store, there's all this behavioral economics. Like, okay, we're going to put like a candy bar at eye level. Like, that's some sort of behavioral hack. No, it's reducing search costs. That is completely compatible with the neoclassical paradigm. Ronald Coase has been talking about this since the 1930s. Yes, there are search costs. And if you reduce search costs, people are more likely to go ahead and exercise whatever that thing is. So let's drop fucking behavioral economics. All economics is behavioral. And let's use research that has replicated over time rather than turning to psychology, which is an absolute shit show for the last 10 years, which still doesn't seem to have made it out of the mainstream. Okay, I'm done. That's all I got, except for FOMO. I don't even want to get started on FOMO. We'll save that for another time. That's another bullshit PM thing, behavioral psychology. See, everyone always works backwards from something that's successful into some sort of psychological trick to make them feel smart, like the battle pass, the FOMO store, the rotating stores, despite all the evidence to the contrary that these things don't work. Call of Duty doesn't have this. Ugh, I can't help myself. I will write about this in the future, but I just can't take it anymore. Stop with the crap.
Wow, now we know how to get Phil going. Just talk a little bit behavioral economics and he turns into young Chris.
You didn't know this?
We'll save it for the Game Economist guest.
All you have to do with Phil is say behavioral economics and FOMO, and then we lose 30 minutes of the podcast.
Dan Ariely.
Dan Ariely. Well, maybe we should talk about market for a second.
Oh, now you're going to hear me talk for 30 minutes. I'm just kidding. So I want to hit some pretty quick earning updates. There's been a lot of the earning news out there. So Roblox, let's start off with them. They saw, my God, a 38% bump in Q3 revenue to 713 million. And their DAU count is finally at 70 million DAU, like huge, huge numbers. I also saw in some of the lower numbers that they were starting to see some significant increases in older players. It's still predominantly, you know, 13 and under, as we know, but they are showing some uptick there. Next, Playtika, they were down 2% from Q2, just like 2%. So they seem to be relatively stable, but slightly down. Obviously, any of the companies that are based in Israel are going to have a little bit more challenges, you know, based off the conflict that's going on in that region. Sony. So this was really interesting. I'll break it down in like software, hardware, and a couple other things. So for a software standpoint, they were up 26%. It was 67-68 million copies sold across all PlayStation consoles. First party, not surprisingly, was almost 5 million of those units, with Spider-Man 2 selling more than 5 million units worldwide as of October 30th. So strong numbers from there. They're a Game of the Year nominee, as to have been expected. Digital software, this is really interesting, was up 39% to 1.32 billion during Q2, while physical titles were down 4% to 231 million. So we're finally transitioning to the age where digital is really, really outpacing what we're seeing in physical. Hardware sales rose 60% to 1.9 billion for PS5, 4.9 million units. As for Sony's game sector, the company is experiencing sales to reach almost 30 billion, a 19% rise over our previous fiscal. I wonder what's covering. So, Chris, this is a little bit of a question for you. These numbers are great. There's a lot of things going on. What is covering for the Destiny and Marathon? You know, maybe more Destiny's date slip. Marathon's really far out, so it's not reflected here. But are we just not hitting that in the fiscal year earnings report? Or is something else just covering it so much that the, I would have to imagine, hundreds of millions of dollar hole from Destiny slipping would cover? I'm just curious.
I think there's two things. One is Spider-Man is doing extremely well. They expect record hardware sales this year. But all of the activity around consoles right now is driving a lot of catalog sales too, in which, you know, they obviously make money on their own catalog, but they make money on every piece of catalog that's sold from third party. So that's probably helping bolster their digital percentage as well as just their overall performance. It's going to be a great year for Sony. The only problem with Sony is that the rest of the company, and there's also a huge problem with the yen. So they have a huge currency exchange rate issue as well, which I'm not going to go into because that's very boring. But nonetheless, the business of PlayStation is doing extremely well.
One thing that was interesting, I'm going to talk about Warner Brothers Discovery next, is there was a quote in their earnings. So first of all, they got wrecked in their overall company earnings. They have zero story for why their business is, you know, linear TV is just falling off a cliff. Unlike Disney, who actually has a story like, hey, we're going streaming. We're going to acquire Hulu full time. We're going to double down on parks. But what they did say about gaming, which is strong for them with Potter and everything and Mortal Kombat, they said this, and you'll love this, Chris. Our focus is on transforming our biggest franchises from largely console and PC based with 3 to 4 year release schedules to include more always on gameplay through live services, multi-platform, and free-to-play extensions, with the goal to have more players spending more time on our platforms. By the way, Mortal Kombat 3 did 3 million units, and Potter, I don't think we have new numbers on Potter, but it was a billion in revenue and 15 million units back earlier when it shipped. Did that feel like a direct lift from the PlayStation? You're rolling your eyes, like in true Crest, no poker face fashion, which I love, and why we're on camera here. Right? Like, this isn't this like bullshit?
Unfortunately, I'm way too close to this. I can't really comment too much on what's going on there, but I will just say that they are very similar to Sony in the sense that they do not have the teams that can execute against what they're suggesting. So it's funny how these things are just kind of on repeat constantly. Like, let's transform our studios that don't know anything about free-to-play or monetization mechanics or anything to services companies. And they can't do it, right? Yeah. I mean, how many times do we have to go through this? So, yes.
You see it with multiverses. You see it at EA with Sims. Sims 4 is a free-to-play version that looks exactly like, you know, classic Sims with monetization. That is, doesn't make any sense. Sorry, Mishka, what were you
going to say? Is it like the same McKinsey consultants are going through these different publishing houses?
No, you don't need a consultant. Why do you need to pay someone to look at what everyone else is doing?
I'm surprised that people did not comment at all on the Sony stuff last week. I mean, dude, this is like a huge problem, right? So like all progress halted, right? On trying to build software as a service. This shit's fucking hard. You know, it's really hard. You can't just fucking say it because some McKinsey consultant was like, oh yeah, you should do software as a service. Yeah, no fucking duh. Of course you should do software as a service, but it ain't easy, you know? Thank you, Mr. McKinsey, Harvard MBA. That's really helpful, right? But find the people that actually can execute against it is fucking hard. And now we'll get to take two, which is almost a different scenario, but the exact same idea. So continue.
Oh, take two. Okay. So this one drives me crazy. Is the lesson here that whenever you need to pump up your stock, all you have to do is just say GTA and a maybe six and a maybe coming? It seems like that. So as of Tuesday, when I looked this up, shares are up 13%. Take-Two's market valuation is up $3 billion with a B, all because they put a tweet out that said, I'm announcing that a trailer is going to drop in December. If you're a marketing person, no pressure. That trailer has a ROI of $3 billion to your company. That might be the single best ROI in the history of marketing, what they just did. And all of it is to pump up a stock just for the next year. That's all they have to do. All these articles I read from these people who don't understand the industry are just like, what? But it's GTA. GTA Online did 150 million units. It's going to, sure, it's going to be great, but do we not care about the entirety of the company or when this is going to ship? If it hits their fiscal, what happens if it doesn't hit their fiscal year, Chris?
Oh,
where do you start?
I don't know where to start on this because, like, I want to be clear. I'm actually been bullish on Take-Two all year, despite the fact that I think Zynga is an absolute train wreck, right? Because I was pretty confident they were going to announce GTA this year. Of course, they didn't announce it till December, but nonetheless, it's been announced and the rumors suggested that and the company suggested that. But anyway, so I feel like I've been right about the stock to some degree, right? And I've definitely been right about Zynga as the biggest failure of M&A in the industry forever. Now, where I am wrong, right, is that the fact is that 50% of their revenue was almost was driven by Zynga in this last quarter, right? Which will change obviously when GTA comes out. But the fact is that they are getting the benefits of that type of scale in the stock price because of the valuation and because of the announcement that GTA is coming, the stock keeps going up. So they are not getting penalized from buying a terrible asset that has declined in value about maybe 50 to 60%, maybe even 80% at this point, right? So that may be where I was wrong. And maybe it was a stroke of genius by Strauss to buy an asset that's becoming more worthless every day. But nonetheless, it's all about GTA, right? And that thing needs to hit, and it needs to hit well. And the irony is, the later they wait, the better that thing will perform because there'll be more hardware sold, more install base to sell into. They'll come out with a PC SKU. So I think this thing will live up to the hype. And now they're talking about episodic content for the story-based game, which I think is brilliant, which I wish they've done last time, which could feed into the online play. Like, they will create a better online service. And you know why? You know why that this makes sense? And the Zasloff at fucking Warner Discovery doesn't make sense? Because they know what they're doing. They have the people that have done this. They know what success looks like, right? And they just are replicating that success and adding on to it, right? Instead of trying to recreate the fucking wheel with people that don't want to do this shit. This is what kills me. The God of War people, Guerrilla, like Naughty Dog, these guys don't want to fucking do this shit, right? So they're not going to do it, right? Because they've been successful their entire careers doing one thing and not the other, right? So anyway, I think the GTA guys will execute against this shit. I think this is Take-Two's like still probably a good buy. I mean, the valuation's getting a little bit insane. And oh, and by the way, they wrote off another $250 million on Zynga again this quarter. That's $500 million already. Wow. Right? And it's going to get worse. And we're going to talk about these games that are coming out. The two biggest IPs that they've come out with in the last like 6 years have been a fucking disaster. Train wrecks. Right? Good luck. Right? Yeah. I don't know what to do at Zynga. I just don't.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape. This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fund really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing a full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
Continue on.
Yeah, I think Brett got me grouchy by talking about being grouchy.
You're at your best when you're grouchy.
I don't know about that. And Amazon is laying off 180 people in the gaming division, specifically the Crown Twitch channel. Evidently, I've been told that these are actually not gaming people necessarily. These are more Prime Gaming org, right? So they're not really actually game makers. It's not as dramatic as it sounds. The funny part for these guys, they're focused on like six MMOs. There's no market for six MMOs in this space, but nonetheless, that's what they're bringing to market. So I'm not really too worried about this. Geo Media conducted 23 layoffs. Oh, across companies. Oh, here we go. Oh my God.
There's a reason I put this in.
Oh my Lord. Including the gaming site that I love, Kotaku. Bye-bye. I think all of them. And it looks like all the leaders of Kotaku that are leading this Marxist revolution have gotten the axe and started their own propaganda bullshit website called Aftermath. And good fucking riddance, dude. You guys are terrible. Absolutely terrible at what you do, okay? You have no idea what you're talking about. And I listened to this woman on the podcast. She was so idiotic about her assessment of the business side of gaming. It's just good riddance. All right, maybe Kotaku will actually become a decent outlet now. Holy crap. All right, fine. Oh God, dude, another one. One after the other. Dude, this is I didn't even know it was gonna be.
I set you up for this one.
The Overwatch League. Gone. Absolutely gone. This premier sports league is transitioning, the company said, Polygon. Dude, they're gonna pay $6 million to these morons that bought teams for $25 million. So now it's going to be operated by the Saudis, right? From this ESL shit, right? What do you think is going to happen? By the way, they did a great job of building a great service, but no one gave a shit. It was a terrible game for fucking esports. So all that money that was spent, hundreds of millions of dollars, how many man hours were spent on this thing? Goodbye. Bye-bye. All right. We're going to talk about it a little bit later. All right, moving on.
All right, investments in M&A. So Finland-based games live streaming startup Noice has raised $21 million in Series A funding from several investors. Noice plans to integrate competitive and cooperative multiplayer gaming with live streaming on a single platform, allowing users to play while watching. Now, of course, I'm rooting for Noice, not because it's only from Finland, but because it's headed by my former investor and very exciting platform. I've been hands-on with it, so interesting to see where that goes. US-based indie games publisher Devolver Digital has acquired US-based game developer System Era Software, known for its debut title, Astroneer, which is multiplayer sandbox exploration game for up to $40 million, including an initial payment of $22 million. Atari is set to acquire US-based retro games developer Digital Eclipse, known for games like Wizardry and Candy Creeps, in a $20 million deal. The acquisition consists of initial payment of $6.5 million. Saudi Arabia-based Neom company has announced a $50 million investment in Hong Kong-based Web3 gaming company Animoca Brands. The investment will support the development of Animoca Brands' Web3 ecosystem and promote technology advancement in Riyadh and the broader Neom region. Chris, is Web3 haram?
I need clarification on this because everything about cryptocurrencies is haram, right? It's forbidden, right? Like, including like gambling, speculation, and usury, like, you know, interest and stuff. And so it's like, exactly how is Anna Mocha going to like thread this fucking needle of Sharia law? I don't get it.
We have a big following in a lot of Muslim countries, Turkey, etc. So let us know if Web3 is haram or not. That's the question of the week. All right, last one. China's ByteDance is talking to likely buyers about gaming unit Moonton's sale. So they are divesting from Moonton, which was known for Mobile Legends Bang Bang and some other hits.
What does that mean? Does that mean they're getting rid of their publishing arm?
I don't know.
We don't know, but that's a pretty long-term thinking. I mean, the publishing arm did Marvel Snap and so forth, but they acquired...
Nuverse.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they acquired Bang Bang quite early, and I remember there were some lawsuits between that and Rise of Kings and the MOBA from Tencent and so forth. So one of the successful MOBAs. Again, MOBAs do well in Asia, especially Southeast Asia.
It kicked League of Legends Wild Rift's ass in Southeast Asia.
Bang, bang.
Speaking of Asia, Tencent announced that DreamStars, their competitor to Stumble Guys, Fall Guys, and Eggy Party, which is from NetEase, has amassed 27 million pre-registrations. Remedy Entertainment, based in Helsinki and with a new Stockholm studio, plans to reboot Codename Vanguard to a premium game with a strong cooperative multiplayer component. Sony stated that of its 12 live service games in development, it will only release 6 by fiscal year 2025, which ends March 2026. Zenless Zone Zero for miHoYo is taking up signups for its closed beta. This one is very different than its other titles. Something to keep track of and certainly something to sign up for.
We talked about it briefly. There's only clips and it's not showing too much gameplay.
It's much more real-time inputs. There's some roguelike elements. They'll have some meta collection. It still has the same art style. Still looks story-based, but set in a more Tokyo-based future in a city. PUBG has returned to Steam's top seller list, topping Modern Warfare 3 in the week ending for November 18th. They had launched a new feature, which drove them to the top. We also saw that early access sci-fi co-op horror title Lethal Company has made its debut at number 8. So we're going back to that thesis we were talking about, co-op shooters potentially having some room to operate on HD.
Interesting part about the Vanguard from Remedy, that has been in development for quite a long time, and it has, to my limited knowledge, been rebooted several times. I did not know that now it has been rebooted to be a premium game. So just looking at the job post they've had, and of course my interaction with Remedy, they are about 2 miles from where I live. It's a game that has been in development for quite a while, and it was moved actually from Helsinki to Stockholm to be developed, and Swedes went premium right away.
Yeah, we'll take this one to completion where you guys couldn't.
By the way, I think this is a bigger trend that we're seeing out there, that people went down this free-to-play rabbit hole for console and realized that it's impossible or very challenging and they don't have the teams to do it. And so they're all kind of retrenching. Obviously, that's what's happening at Remedy.
Don't forget the Disney game. That's pivoted it as well.
Well, they just need to read some Dan O'Reilly books and then all that shit, thinking fast and slow. Then they can convert to free-to-play. No big deal.
We'll have a deconstructor of fun book club next week. Phil, I want you to do a book banning and we'll set spires to some of these books. And then I want your list to come in of what people should be reading.
Psychologists do a lot of self-harm.
Or correct.
I don't read. I'm out.
All right, let's talk about which games deserve awards.
Oh, yes. So the Game Awards, Jeff Keighley's award show coming up the first week of December on December 7th in LA. The nominees are out, and I just wanted to pull out two of the topics to talk about. So Game of the Year, I wanted to pull out two of these categories. Game of the Year, Alan Wake. So Crest, this is the one we've been talking about all year. It's in a ton of the awards. Alan Wake 2, Baldur's Gate 3. I mean, if this game doesn't win, I don't know what should win. Marvel's Spider-Man 2, Resident Evil 4. I have no idea why this would be on the list. Super Mario Brothers Wonder. Laura is very happy to. I've actually been playing it, and I don't know why I'm an elephant, but it is a little bit joyous to be an elephant.
It's fun.
It's kind of fun. Legends of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom definitely deserves to be on that list. So that's Game of the Year overall. We all know it's typically the console games. Best mobile game. So this is going to be a fun list. I can't wait to go through this list. Final Fantasy VII Ever Crisis, Honkai Star Rail. Okay, fine. Honkai, I get it, right? Hello Kitty Island Adventure in the let's try to make Apple Arcade really happy that we picked one of their games to put it on the list. Monster Hunter Now, and then Terra Nil, which is a Netflix game, which again, if I were to just read the tea leaves here, they took every single like tertiary category of mobile, best Apple Arcade game, best Netflix game, best Japanese anime game, best something else that has nothing to do with any, because three of these are Japanese inspired, and let's throw it into a list. I'll just hand it to Crest because this list makes me incredibly sad. And later on, we should talk about doing our own award show or being the, you know, the providers of this, because this is embarrassing to all of those that are in mobile.
Look, I like award shows. Award shows are great, but it's pretty much fucking meaningless after the fact promotion, which is fine, right? It's an accolade on the box. And I think actually the console list is quite good. I don't know why Resident Evil is on there. That doesn't even make any sense to me because I don't know. Starfield should be on there, but I guess it was more of a divisive game for people. But I don't know. I'm sure that was kind of a controversial omission to some degree for some people. I haven't really been reading up on it. But the mobile list is fucking ridiculous. This mobile list doesn't make any sense. Like Honkai, yes. Monster Hunter, maybe. Right? But where's Monopoly Go? Where's like Whiteout Survival, Call of Dragons? Where are these games that did really well this year? They're just completely missing from this. And by the way, Monster Hunter is dying a quick death. I hope everyone's like observing this. It's like basically a big shark fin that's dying, even in Japan. And Terra Nil, dude, that had like 1.4 million downloads, right? Hello Kitty on Apple Arcade. What the fuck is going on, right? I mean, you have to ask yourself, like, why in the fuck would these games be on a list like this, right? And the only reason is because they're like kissing the ring of Apple and Netflix, right? And kissing their ass, more like it, right? It's like, it's bullshit, right? And clearly, this panel either, one, knows nothing about mobile, right? Or two, they just are basically trying to kiss ass on Netflix and Apple because none of those games belong on a list of top games in mobile.
Agree.
Terra Nil is not even a mobile game. It's like one of those like Netflix.
It is.
No, but like not originally, right? It can be. Like UX is horrible.
Oh, was it on PC before? Oh my God. Tell me that's not true.
Phil gave a thumbs up.
Oh.
It's like one of those.
Tell me that's not true.
It's on Steam as well.
Motherfuckers. Yes. No way. Dude, you can't do that. Oh. You cannot do that. Like, that is like so despicable.
It's not even a mobile native game and they pick to be a best mobile.
They got to consult people that know something about mobile, for Christ's sake. You know? Jesus Christ.
It's a UX mess. That's what Terra Nil is. It's like, you know,
just give us a call.
Oh my Lord,
friend. I think we're happy to help, or we're happy to do it ourselves. So Mishka, we're getting close to time for the Deconstructor of Fun Awards. We announced a bunch of the categories that we're going to have a couple months ago. I did an article in the newsletter. We talked about do award shows mean anything, and you know, the gist is, like Chris said, not necessarily, but it is a wonderful thing for you to have as a game maker. Like, it's fun to go to award shows. It's fun to get the kudos. So we'll talk about, like, do we have a Slack? Are we going to set up a survey? What are we going to do? But let me just remind you of the categories. And the categories we picked are, let's just say, represent the snarky, rebellious nature of our lovely cast and crew here as we come in with some fun names. Okay, so here they go. Talk of the year. So this could be a news or a trend. Correction of the year. What we as a group got wrong in a really big way. And we kind of do this every episode, but we're going to go pick the best, worst thing that we did. Most damage received. So this is a company, a platform, or a genre that took a hit. The You Crushed It Game Award. So this is the best creative plus business. So this is where Monopoly Go would go. This is where a Honkai. This is where the, from a mobile perspective, how we all look at what a winner is, this is it. The most disappointing game, maybe Nil makes this. No, I'm just kidding. I haven't played that game. The Mice Nuts game. This is a small game that doesn't do maybe big numbers, but we really love to play it. The most skeptical and the most brilliant move. This could have been like an investment, an acquisition, a talent move, and the best layoffs. Phil added.
I don't know about that one. Where did that category
this was
come
not on my. I just want to say. Not on
that's horrible.
Although I actually got some nominees going, though. I'll tell you that much, dude. I could come up with a bunch.
Yeah, this is not the first time we're doing it. It's kind of like getting more and more official. So maybe this time we'll put on the suits and everything and do a digital. And then a year after that, we do it physical in LA, Microsoft Movie Theater, or wherever that award show was held. But last year's winner, we had a little bit of a different categories, but mostly the same. So the talk of the year was Meta losing $15 billion in trying to build a metaverse, as well as the collapse of FTX. Those are kind of like the two big ones. The trend of the year was bear market. So that was kind of thing. And then we did a prediction for 23 was the 2023 will be the year of austerity and efficiency. Looking like a lot of truth there. The biggest winner last year was Activision Blizzard. King was growing on mobile while their competitors were in trouble. Blizzard's Diablo Immortal reached 300 million in just 6 months, and Call of Duty was kicking ass on all platforms. More on that, if that's still going on, in the next article, maybe with Jen. The biggest loser last year, definitely not the loser this year, is AppLovin'. Their stock was 10% at the time when we were recording this, compared to a year before. So only 10th of what it was. An honorable mention went to all the investors who deployed funds into Web3 games. So that's a long list.
How did that not win?
It's too broad.
I guess we didn't know that back then.
Yeah, these things change.
AppLovin's up like 400% or more now. So like they're still like 40% of what they used to be. But
last year looked bad, but this year they've been on a killing spree. The biggest game of last year was Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. Warfare 3 is not looking that way, which becomes the fastest selling Call of Duty ever, hitting 1 billion in sales in just 10 days. The most underperforming game of 22 was Sky Mavis's Axie Infinity. That was a fall from grace. You know, at one point they were putting out articles how they're beating Candy Crush Saga, you know, by a big margin. And then the skeptical move of last year was the competition between Embracer and Netflix, because Netflix was building Apple Arcade 2.0. And the winner, with Chris's powerful voice, was of course Embracer and their move of paying $780 million to acquire Lord of the Rings IP.
I'm telling you, I am fucking Nostradamus on this shit, dude. Yeah. I predict the future, right? I mean, come on, man. Embracer is like dog shit now. You know?
And it wasn't that they acquired the Lord of the Rings IP, but they acquired it without the movie or TV show rights. So it basically like they could draw their own dwarves and sell games with that and not use the ones that everybody knows. So
sold the branding person. Yeah.
Now they're selling it for parts.
I'm sure all the Swedish studios are doing
it. We're rocking it. Phil. Yeah. I mean, we got your co-op shooter that you couldn't finish off. Yeah.
Damn. All right. So coming soon, some sort of survey where you can all give us nominations and then we will start on the road to the Deconstructor of Fun Game Award show coming soon. One game that was not on anyone's award list this year was Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. There was a really great Forbes article, and I just want to title this section, "What the Hell Happened to Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3? I want to read this quote because this isn't me. This is from the article. "As its final act of stupidity before being acquired by Microsoft, Activision decided to stain the legacy of Call of Duty in a way that we simply have not seen before. According to internal reports, Activision negated a proposed sequel to Advanced Warfare and had Sledgehammer turn around a new campaign for Modern Warfare 3 in just 16 months, a project that many were originally told was just an expansion of the previous year's game, but it was turned into a full $70 offering later." That's the quote. I was like, oof, pretty harsh. Result: Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 is the lowest scored game in the entire history of the series. Not just that, it's the lowest by a huge amount. On PlayStation 5, so this is the Metacritic that I saw, and I looked up the other day. I don't know if we should check now. It was at 50, and a 1.4 out of 10 on the user scale. It is getting rating bombed like crazy, and ironically, people are bombing the wrong game because there was, I think you all know, there was another game called Modern Warfare 3. Really confusing. It's a 2011 version of it. So it might not even have all of the negative review bombs because people are doing the wrong game. It's also on Steam. It has a mostly negative. And so you can go back and look. The only other worst game, I think, was Vanguard at a 73. Everything else, you know, Call of Duty tends to be in the 80s, and it's a really well-beloved franchise. So there was another article that the Wall Street Journal just did about the Activision-Microsoft deal in general, and it was cool. They gave a lot of numbers on the size of the franchise. And when you think about What a crappy way for Microsoft and Xbox team to get handed the keys to the kingdom when they did all of that negotiation around like Call of Duty and then, you know, they get handed the turd. I know that Diablo came in and delivered, right? Like Diablo 4 crushed it. Call of Duty, they didn't think that was going to be the problem. And guess what? So according to many of these reports, and this is disputed, you know, the developer says they were crunched and it was intended for DLC, and spokespeople dispute this. I think one thing that's for sure is we just got to give people time to make great products, hence the GTA 6 that we were talking about. So Call of Duty is one of the top gaming franchises in the world. Obviously, probably Fortnite comes in ahead of them. It's a $3.2 billion annual business across all of the different platforms. Just for fun, in this article, this Wall Street Journal article, I went in, looked at the other ABK franchises, although ABK may or may not exist anymore. I think I saw an article, they're going to let Blizzard be Blizzard, which, like, praise God, like, let Blizzard be Blizzard and don't have anybody fuck with them. Let them do their thing. That's what they do best. You hear from Irvine a sigh of relief come when I thought I read that news. So anyway, so it goes Call of Duty at 3.2, Candy Crush at 2.3 billion. One mobile game is $2.3 billion annually, everybody. Diablo is a billion. Wow. Who would have guessed? 800 million. And then Overwatch is 300 million. Just for fun, I was like, hey, what's Call of Duty Mobile? Call of Duty Mobile is the same size as Overwatch. Approximately, you know, I data AI and I went and added some things up. It's about the same size as Overwatch is Call of Duty Mobile by itself, not Warzone. We'll figure out what happens with Warzone later. So I just wanted to think about this story from a brand standpoint. Sorry, I'll wrap this up. Is I know it feels like nothing anyone can do can fuck up Call of Duty and that franchise and what it means to players. But does this time actually tarnish the game a little bit? In fact, I think if anything, it probably tarnishes Sledgehammer more than the brand. Because the next game to come is a Treyarch game, right? Like, you know, and everyone's like, oh, Treyarch, you know, it used to be the other guys and now it's Treyarch. And so, Chris, I was just thinking about if you're forecasting this business, and we talked a little bit about this with like FIFA and FC, do you forecast a down round next year after this debacle? Or do you say, hey, it's Treyarch, it doesn't matter. Maybe you look ahead and be like, ooh, Sledgehammer, sorry, guys. No, it wasn't your call, but what do you think?
Let me just back up. So it's a disappointing game after a great game last year. Well, like, let's be clear, right? And, you know, they just crushed it last year. I do think the studios were pushed to get something out. There was lots of rumors that this game wasn't coming out, that they were going to skip a year. And they were kind of communicating that to Wall Street, but they flipped on that. And it may have been because they didn't expect the acquisition to go through and they need something for performance this year. They thought Diablo would offset whatever. I don't know. Like, there's all kinds of moving parts going on when they were making this decision to make this game. But to be clear, I don't think this is damaging to Call of Duty really at all, right? It's the only game in town, right? There's only one competitive shooter that sells on console the way this game does. And people are going to play it until there's an alternative. And I don't even see an alternative in the next 2 to 3 years. Battlefield's the only competitor, and you know, that's really going to be nascent for a while. Although evidently it's a great game. Anyway, the point is, this is the only game in town for shooters, and people are going to keep playing it. And I think the game itself has enough. The single player was an absolute travesty. I mean, it was awful, right? It was just like phoning it in. But the customers are loyal to the franchise and the gameplay and the leveling up and the guns, and I think it will be fine. And to be clear, as you said, the next year is the hero SKU from Treyarch, which is a Black Ops game, which happens to be in the Middle East, which is super topical, which is historically done quite well. And then after that, I guess we'll see what they end up doing in terms of managing the franchise with Microsoft, because actually year-on-year cadence may not make sense, but we know that the game's coming out next year. So we'll see. But no, I think this is just kind of a hiccup. I think the game will be fine. I think the fact that the install base is getting so big and console like engagement so high, I think Call of Duty will do fine. Thank you very much. Actually, down 25% of retail in the UK is actually not that bad because it's going more and more digital these days. So that's not as bad as it sounds. So I bet they're down about 10, 15% max by the end of the year.
So what I don't understand is what happened to the three-studio, three-year cascading strategy. This, to me, was Bobby's brilliant play to increase the supply of Call of Duty. So you'd have three studios, they'd have three-year dev cycles each, and so you could have a cascading release every single year. And I keep hearing whispers that this has started to crater. Everything's becoming more and more centralized. I mean, you boot up this game, you have to boot up Modern Warfare 2 to get to Modern Warfare 3. It's the same UI, and what's happened? Like, how did they get to this point?
What ended up happening is that Sledgehammer just fucking blew the fuck up, right? So all the Sledgehammer people left, like the senior leadership there left. And so that created this gaping hole of someone to manage that third cycle. But Treyarch and Infinity Ward are still up and running. But I think that disrupted a lot of things. I'm not going to go into all the nitty gritty here because I know way too much about this shit. But ultimately now, basically, it seems like almost the entire org is working on every game. You know, like, I think there's like a core group of people on each of the three studios that are working on the concept for their game. But I think every studio seems to be working on Call of Duty every year. A lot of the drama had to do with tech issues about which engine to use because everyone was using a different engine at one point. It's very complex. But let me just say this. It seems they still have the capability of releasing a game every year. They could have that capability. I just don't think Microsoft needs to do that going forward.
This kind of accidentally serves, I would argue, as the corporate strategy, which is to make Call of Duty a platform, which is to maintain the UI, maintain the store. Like, this is the question we always had on Battlefield, and specifically executives. Why in God's name are we rebuilding everything every single year for every single game? And it's very tempting to say, like, let's centralize things, which is how you get stuff like Frostbite. But Call of Duty is starting to become a platform. It's like, okay, we're going to start to launch sub-games on this platform. That's a completely separate experience, but let's launch Call of Duty Zombies. That's coming back. Let's try an extraction shooter. Let's launch it on Call of Duty. Like, these games are starting to become platforms, and I'm interested to see if they can start to take more advantage of that. Like, cosmetics transferred over. Very interested to see how that will hit MTX in the next fiscal year. That, to me, was an incredibly consequential decision that doesn't feel like it's gotten enough attention. I don't have to start from all over again. This isn't FIFA Ultimate Team. I don't need to repurchase everything again. I don't need to climb my OVR ranking. I'm going to have all my cosmetics from Modern Warfare 2. That to me is something to watch.
But that's not good from a spend perspective.
Oh, I agree on the spend perspective. Keeping a lot of the same tools in tech, there might be something to that. Of course, like, you're going to have path dependency. Like, the more you centralize things, the more you have to coordinate with these teams. Treyarch, I'm sure, is going in their own direction because they couldn't fit their hero shooter on, I'm sure, the engine, the UI, the UX, how they've set up things for the Infinity Ward saga.
Well, I don't know if this is true, but I think all the tech is now standardized across the three studios, but that could be bullshit. But I mean, obviously they were all working on the same platform. How about this? The fundamental thing here is that things should change, right? They do not have yearly earnings to worry about, quarterly earnings that Activision had. So they had to get a game out because the game does 20 million units plus, like between 20 and 30 million units, you know, of $60 product, right? That's over $1 billion every year. Like,
it's up to 70 now, right?
Yeah, right. So my point is, it's a huge revenue generator. They couldn't live without it. But I don't think Microsoft is going to require as much consistency because they care about the subs, right? They're losing money hand over fist at that gaming company. So anyway, I think things will change. I think it'll be interesting to see how they build it and how they screw over Sony, you know, moving forward, you know, trying to be compliant with what they agreed to with the agencies, but they're going to try to like push the envelope or push the needle to hurt Sony ultimately, right? So we'll see.
Hey, game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Exola's got your back with Exola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Exola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Exola's PayStation in action? Visit exola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description. I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs.
Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
So going, talking a little bit about Take-Two and Zynga's new game. So Match Factory has officially been, it's been said it's a global release, but after digging into data AI, it seems to be very focused on UK. So numbers in data AI yet are not yet populating for a global audience. It's an interesting game. I'm not sure it's going to be a success, but I'll explain why it's interesting. I think this is a play from Zynga Peak trying to stay relevant, because what they're doing is they're basically taking the what we see as kind of the sorting a pile of stuff mechanic, which is usually called match 3D, match two items from a pile with a timer, and they're taking the popularized by Good Job Games and tile match, which is match three tiles with like a limit bar at the bottom. It's also done by Spike Games, and Jen will talk about this later. So they're combining those two mechanics, which have seen kind of some levels of success. They're actually seeing probably more success in the creative that's being used to bring in players. People seem to like looking at those types of ads, but as a mechanic, I think it's a little bit tricky for a casual puzzle player. So this game, Match Factory, takes those two mechanics, mushes them together. That's their engine. And what they're trying to do is put the Match 3 playbook, so what we see works, win streaks, hard level labeling, events, into this game. It's polished. I'll give Zynga that. It's what I would expect from a Peak game, 100%. And there's some cute callbacks to Toon Blast and Toy Blast in the actual pieces themselves. The interesting part they're adding is timed, which is usually a no-no for puzzle players because it adds a layer of stress that kind of counters what a lot of players come in wanting to do. They want to relax. They want to escape. They want to play at their own pace. And this turns that on its head. The timer, first 70 levels, super relaxed. You're like, kind of like, how is this game going to make money? Especially with the win streak. What I will say is this type of game is going to require a very different level designer, like mindset, than a match three game. What is going to be deemed difficult? You wouldn't be able to hire someone that's made match three levels and just completely port them over. They're going to have to think about how to approach difficulty in a different way. You're looking at now 3D objects. You have to look at the amount of stuff, the shape and color of stuff. Like, the more similar the items look, that is going to drastically affect the difficulty of the level and then therefore a lot of the monetization in this. That's one area I think they did a very good job. I had to sort through a pile of pink stuff and it was so difficult. So thinking about how contrasting colors work, contrasting shapes, there's another level of thinking that's going to go into this. The meta so far, super light. It's very Toon Blast-y. There are events. There's very light events. I think they're going to have to experiment to figure out how to make that work. There's no decoration, no fanfare. You're earning stars, rewards that help you in the core puzzle. So earn stars, get stuff. Core puzzle gets easier. There's teams. There's going to be leaderboards. I expect them that they're going to expand further. Jen, what are your thoughts so far?
Yeah, I was excited to see a Peak game. I think I told you guys I love Toon Blast. I'm like an end gamer on Toon Blast. I really enjoy what Spike, who is the Peak leadership, left and went to Spike, and they have Tile Busters. I love what they do in Tile Busters. Just like pinnacle masterclass of how you set up metagame systems around core gameplay. So I played a lot to try to get through and unlock. I was like waiting for all of the meta stuff to kick in, and it just didn't. So when I played Tile Busters, what I loved about it was I got this great constant feeling of as I got to level 20 to 30 to 40, stuff kept unlocking for me. Oh, now you have a synchronous play. Oh, now you have this team-based event. Oh, now you have this. And so I felt like I was unfolding into a game that was giving me more and more metagame systems that were going to really keep me engaged. This really fun, like Jack and this Beanstalk ladder that if I kept my streak going, I kept my rewards going, all of these great things in Tile Busters. So in this game, here, let me just talk about like the gameplay itself. This is a very hot UA worthy play pattern, this match 3D. All I see in UA now are iterations on picking shit out of a pile of junk and matching it together, or picking it from a rotating thing. So in fact, even Tilebusters has this as a button inside of their game, because you can imagine what they're doing, what Envoy has done, all these games have done. They found that this UA really works. And so they want to make sure inside the game that if you want to just play those match 3D things, here you go. We're not fake adding you. There's a place for you to do that. So that would be the strategy. It's actually a great strategy, and everyone should do that if you are having problems with the UA and you find something that works. That's a way to do it that doesn't piss off your user base, by the way. So here what they did is, like you said, they combined this, I'm going to go through a pile of shit, pick things out, but instead of moving the pile, it has to go to a match bar. And so you've got the pressure there. So number one is, I also didn't like the time pressure as somebody playing these games. My motivation is to relax and to escape, and I'm kind of put off by how pressured I feel. They don't do a good job in the UI of like really letting me know when I'm coming to the end of my tile bar. Next thing I know, I'm like, I failed. And there's no like gently bleeps red when the time is running out. And I'm like, next thing I know, I'm out. Like, make these things obvious, and then I'll spend a booster to like keep these things going. So I was really disappointed in some of the basic core gameplay was like not awesome.
That's also going to be key for monetization for them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like, that make that a big deal and I'll spend money because I have to buy the fan booster or the other booster or whatever. So I didn't see any events. I didn't see asynchronous PvP, which is the core of a lot of these things. And then also to your point about the theme, there wasn't a thematic wrapper. There wasn't anything bringing this together. Like maybe Junkyard, maybe Hoarders. I felt like I was an episode of Hoarders. Maybe Dumpster Diver. Like I felt like I was diving into a dumpster and like going through all this stuff, because each of the levels feels like I'm just sifting through a garbage pile in a bad episode of the Hoarders TV show. Like, so go license one of these shows, put that together. Maybe you can do some co-branding opportunities. The layer licensing guys should be out there signing that up right away and going to Zynga. So maybe there's some potential with this game. This to me looks like a soft launch, like a first 3 to 6 months of a soft launch. Why on earth would you have this and call this a global launch? You know, Zynga knows better. Like, what the fuck?
I didn't get that either. But okay, instead of Dumpster Divers, actually, do you know what could be an interesting IP for this? Toy Story. Something with like cute toys, recognizable, that you could put that. Anyway, that could really fit.
What about I Spy?
What is I
Spy? The beloved books.
Let's bring that shit back.
I Spy is one. You never had those books as a kid?
Oh, the like, dude, I Spy.
Dude, you're too young, man.
Yeah.
I Spy's amazing.
Phil, remember the boomer conversation from last week with Chris and I?
I Spy's still going. It's great. There's a whole New York Times piece on how they do photography. What if you reimagine this as like a hidden object game? I mean, first of all, to your point, there's no meta on this. And what's really compelling about this game is that you're collecting 3D items and they feel so tactical. And even when you get to that home screen, you see all the objects that you collected in the level go into that box. So it feels like you have some level of possession over them. Whereas when you play Candy Crush, it's just gems that are exploding. It's a consumable. Whereas these, I feel like I'm collecting them. Like, I want to own them. I want to build a shelf of all the cool things I've collected and uncovered. I think there's definitely something there. But to your point, Jen, I don't get it. What the fuck? Like, what were they doing by... They issued a press release for this.
I know.
Why are they going global? Like, the playbook for mobile is known. You don't launch things and burn your golden cohort if the KPIs aren't there. And the KPIs are literally missing. We don't know what they are.
Yeah, it's too early. I feel like they're doing more of a measurement right now to look at KPIs as opposed to doing a global launch.
It is a global launch, though. They literally said it's a global launch. Why not just Philippines, Australia, Sweden, Ireland, Canada, United States, right?
Somebody hit go on a press release that wasn't ready because and granted, in data AI, things are slower to pick up.
Yep.
But, you know, from the country breakdown, from the numbers, I think when I looked this weekend, it was like, it peaked at like 30,000 downloads in a day. And then it went down. It went down like on Sunday or something. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, but you look at the countries on that. The download for countries, it's majority UK. So we need to wait for more data, see if it picks up. But it does not look like a global release right now.
No, but it is a global release. Like, I can download it in the US.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah, I mean, we all did. You're right. So something is wrong that we are not seeing. So somebody tell us. next time. When we'll keep an eye on this because it is Zynga. Yeah. It's peak.
They're not a no-name studio. This is their jam. Match stuff.
Well, I'm more curious to see, like, does this work? I think there's a lot of bets being taken by a lot of different companies that tile match and 3D match are the new way forward in an era where you need to be looking at mini games, looking for low CPIs. And I'm more curious to see, is this strategy going to work?
So when you look at the evolution and growth of the match genre, you don't think that core mechanics have driven a lot of it? You think we should focus on live operations and the core around the mechanics? Like, when I think about Toon Blast's revolution, it was about that mechanic that's different than the swiping mechanic. Isn't that what's driven a lot of the growth in the genre?
It wasn't, though. So you have to remember, Pet Rescue Saga was already doing Blast. They were leaders in the Blast category, and then Toy and Toon Blast came after that. So what they did is they polished it up, they made it better, and then they simplified it by removing the meta. I think they had a stronger core mechanic. I think the look and feel was an upgrade as well. So they came with a different offering, and I think that's where they did it right. And I feel like they're trying to replicate that a little bit now with going into the tile match plus sorting market. Everyone's looking for the next new engine. Making a master game is hard. Blast, hard. I think Wonder Blast is a good shot, but making a Blast game is hard. And so people are looking, well, we can't keep offering the same engine. What can we do next? And I feel like these are the different bets. This is why Tile Blast started. This is why Match 3D is being picked up. I don't know if they're going for gold here. I think that's going to be a hard mechanic that's going to be as mass market as Match 3, as Swiper. But I think they're looking for something that's probably good enough. That is my guess.
Oh, I got it. So if they don't get the hoarder's license, and by the way, I'm joking about this, then they should put a theme park theme on it, and then it would be really successful.
Oh, nice callback.
Data park with a family.
I only have one comment on this one now that I've actually looked into it a little bit. I was going to actually just put this in the top troops category, which they just left this thing out to die. But that's clearly not what's happening. Because I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that they have some like master strategy about rolling this out slowly. And I think what Laura said, like the KPIs will speak for themselves and they'll start juicing it. I don't know if I agree with that strategy, but we'll see what happens, right? We'll see if this is like the new way of launching games in some like, you know, different dimension, because that's just not typically how you do it. You go big or go home type thing. But I will back up and say I could be wrong on this. The metrics are not terrible. I mean, they're not great, but the metrics are not terrible. And maybe they'll scale it later. My gut tells me that they're not getting the money and they're putting together a strategy because they're not getting the money, as opposed to actual strategy that's built from a position of strength. I think Take-Two is fucking sick of this bullshit of them losing money on their UA spend. And the paybacks are like 24 months or bullshit, right? And so they're not allowing them to spend the way they want to spend. And so they're coming up with some fucking cockamamie strategy to grow games. That doesn't mean it won't be successful. We'll see, right? We'll see, right? But clearly, I want to be clear on this. They let Top Troops out to die, right? That game is not doing shit, right? They're not scaling it. They're not spending. So let's see if they start increasing spending. We'll keep tracking this one and see. So I am taking back my objection to having this on the podcast. I was wrong. I think this is actually an important one now that I look at it a little bit closer. But anyway, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris, that there must be something here. But what I really don't understand, I think I got to level 70. Maybe all the meta stuff kicks in at 100. I don't know why it wouldn't. I put in some serious hours into this game that I wanted to get back with my life because it stressed me out. The audience for this game is a very specific type of person who does well with the time-based play, who craves that. I generally don't find that to be the same consumer that is a mass market consumer or player. So the complete lack of meta in a game, it just, all of my marketing bones of my body are like, why on earth would you do this? This is like one of the top things I talk to people about when I talk to clients is like, okay, what are we doing to wrap this? What are the features in the wrapper? How do the features in the meta wrapper fit to the motivations and the play patterns that the player wants to engage in? Do they want to engage in social? Do they want to engage in asynchronous PvP? I feel like is the next frontier, even for a casual audience, because you fake social. You know, you think that you're playing against your friends, but it's async and you don't really have to be online at the same time. I think a lot of this, Monopoly Go proves this, right? Monopoly Go just brought in all of your friends. You feel like you're playing with them, even though they probably haven't played the game in 3 months. they're still in your game and they're on your board. Anyway, that's a whole other podcast on that.
All right, we're ending with a question. Did you like the balance of the episode? Is there anything more or less we should cover? We want your feedback. Post it on Spotify, post it in the Slack. Let us know. And on that note, see you next week.
Bye.
Peace out.
You did it. You made it to the end of the episode. As a fan of the show, it would help us out if you subscribe and leave us a review on the podcast service of your choice. More importantly, are you a member of the Deconstructor of Fun Slack group? If you have 5 years or more of games industry experience, go to deconstructoroffun.com/slack and apply to join. Join the games industry's best professional community, filled with peers always willing to lend a hand. Or subscribe to our newsletter to get all the latest insights from the Deconstructor of Fun content creators. Thanks for listening.